You are now listening to
Chakras and Shotguns.
Welcome back to Chakras and Shotguns, episode 16. I'm Mick.
And I'm Jen. Welcome back.
So how are you doing today, baby?
I'm doing pretty good. It's recording day. Busy, busy. Yeah, I have a great interview coming up in this episode. But I wanted to talk about my new favorite show. I think the last time I brought up something that I watched on Netflix, it was Korean. This time it's something on Netflix, but it's French. And it's a show called Into the Night, and it's in its second season. And let's talk about stress, okay? The premise of the show is just like a natural occurrence. Whatever is, like when the sun rises, whatever is touched by the sunlight is basically nuked by gamma rays. So none of the food has any nutritional value. All the people die. And there are these people on this plane, and they're just continuously flying. Forgive me, y'all. I forget which direction.
West. Sun rises in the east, sets in the west.
Yes. So they're continuously flying west, trying to avoid the sun, or they all die. And you want to talk about stress? And there's no food. Like, none of the food tastes good anymore. They're trying to figure out what in the world they're going to be able to eat. I don't know how you prep for that.
I would just lay down at that point. I don't have enough preps. I'm not low enough into the crust of the earth to survive the gamma rays. I'm just, all right, we're just going to go ahead and go.
Yeah. It's not a great one for like preparedness. Like, I mean, unless you have like the money to build a bunker that's like super underground, but, it's like really good, great suspense, really great cast. And stressful AF, but I love it.
I think one of the things you talked to me about is like there's a certain like psychology that happens during prepping situations that I think they get into because, you know, like, you know, they're in kind of a secure space at a certain point. Mm-hmm. And you were like, you know, people just start messing things up. Right. And it's like you were like really harping on this idea of like if you're in this scenario, how you should be behaving.
Yeah. And, you know, this comes up often for me watching these shows. I mean, pre-kids, I was like, kids are always fucking it up. They always mess things up. Carl was the worst on Walking Dead. It's like, I mean, he saved it at the end, but it was about to be like, to this day, like, I can't stand Carl. But yeah, like the takeaway is make sure your kids have some freaking home training before y'all are in this situation. Like, I mean, sometimes you just, it is what it is. Like, yeah. They're too small to like really grasp what's going on. But like, you know, this ain't the time for play. Like, this is life and death. Like, you need to like tighten it up.
And you also mentioned just like some adults, like not knowing their role and like, you know, making sure if you're in that situation, like, especially if you're a guest in someone else's prepped up situation.
Yes. Oh, yes. This is what we were talking about. Yes. Thank you for reminding me. I think that this is a rule of thumb for prepping, but also life. Make sure that whatever space you enter, you're going to make it better before you leave. Don't come in messing stuff up, you know, being dirty, being unhelpful, using up all the resources, and that applies to life. Try and make the spaces that you enter better than they were before you showed up.
I like it. So I wanted to talk really briefly, and I think this will lead into our breath work. So there's a book I've been reading. It's called The Power of Now. It's by Eckhart Tolle. And what's so great about this book, it really, you know, essentially helps us to appreciate where we are in this moment. There are a lot of folks who have like this destination bias, I think is the right term for it, where you're always looking forward to the next destination or goal in life. Like, you know, it could be something small, like, well, once I make it out of this quarter at work, things will be much better in my life. Or it could be as long term as, well, once my kids graduate from high school and get out of the house, my life's going to be better. Or once I have enough money saved up for a retirement, then things are going to be better, right? Like, there's this constant looking forward to this next moment in life, and we devalue the now.
I actually saw, speaking of that, I saw a clip or like a screen grab from Mad Men, and what was the main character's name? Don Draper. Mm-hmm. Don Draper said, what is happiness? It's the moment before we need more happiness.
Exactly. I think there's a lot of folks in our current kind of consumerism society who live like that, right? Like, it's all about the next shot of dopamine, right? Or like mm-hmm. that next achievement. And so the book just really encourages us to turn off our active mind and to really be in this moment at this very second. The present is all that exists. The past is just a recollection of, you know, a past present moment, right? But you're only ever living the present. So yeah, it gets into some deeper level philosophy. But I really like it. I think maybe like one day we can do like something with it where we, you know, once I finish the book, we could like do some sort of discussion series or something, or like a book club where we feature it or something. I think that could be something cool that we could do with, you know, like real time with like our audience.
Yeah. Let's flesh that out. And then okay. I'd have to read the book too.
Well, but. Yeah. So stay tuned. Yeah. Maybe more to come there. But yeah, it's a really good book. But that being said, I think for today's breathwork, and I know we've done something similar to this before, but it's always good to do it again. I just want, as we go into this, everyone just to take a moment, and I'll try not to talk too much, and really just have a moment where we are focused on the now and what our body is doing in this moment. So really just focusing on the inhale and exhale of your breath. So let's do three breaths, really deep breaths, expanding with our belly as we inhale and contracting that belly as we exhale. So let's do three nice and slow breaths there. Awesome, guys. I just want to challenge you guys before you go to bed tonight, try that exercise again and just really get your mind into the space of being focused on the now and being very aware of your body and where you are.
Thanks, Meg. That was great.
All right. So let's talk about our guest today. We are welcoming to the show a good friend of mine. This brother has a lot going on. Mm-hmm. He is a serial entrepreneur, he's an author, he's a farmer, an investor, and financial expert. He has degrees from Vanderbilt and Harvard. He is a co-founder of the CMOS Alliance, a co-founder of the Black Star Capital Network, and is a partner for HBCU Impact Capital. And he is also a brother of the first, the oldest, the coldest fraternity out there, Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity Incorporated.
Now, don't alienate the rest of our listeners now.
I mean, if you couldn't tell, I'm an alpha too. So, yeah, that's my guy.
So this interview was really interesting. We really dived really deep into the topic, and the episode is very focused on the Black community and Black financial wellness. So when I say that, I mean that Trey is very focused on empowering his and personally, Mick and I's own community, which is the Black community. But that being said, I think there's a lot for everyone to gain from taking these concepts and applying them to however you define community, whether that's through the lens of culture, geography, interests. You know, I would challenge anyone, including our Black listeners, but anyone to reflect on what community means to you and how you want to uplift that community and how we can all be more collective. And I think trying to get to the collective is something that Mick and I are really, really interested in and like really want to explore more on this podcast is, you know, spiritually, how can we be more collective? And in prepping, like, how can we be more collective and how can we better build community? Because we're all better together, right? Especially in a disaster type of situation. So I think doing that reflection on, like, what does community really mean to me and what does that look like and how do I define my community? I think it's really easy to engage with today's content.
Yeah, definitely. So with no further ado, we'll get into our interview with Trey Baker.
So, Trey, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and what you're doing now?
Yeah. So, this is always a hard question for me. So I'm from Louisville, Kentucky, born and raised. Come from a farming family. So the rest of my family's from rural Kentucky and Ohio. And, you know, I found out pretty early that I had the entrepreneurial spirit, the entrepreneurial bug. So I was, you know, selling candy to my classmates in middle school. And in high school, I was doing a little fashion design, like designing my own shoes and clothes and stuff like that. So I thought I was going to go into business. But at some point along the way, I was good at math and science. So somebody convinced me to go into engineering, because they thought it'd be a better career path for me. So I ended up going to Vanderbilt for engineering. And about one semester in, I decided engineering wasn't going to work for me. But I stuck it out because I didn't want to, you know, take extra time to graduate and by switching majors. So I just basically switched to engineering science and management of technology, which gave me more of a business and engineering background. And then, so I ended up finishing, you know, in 4 years with that engineering degree and decided to go straight into business school. Unlike this time, I did not listen to everybody who told me, you know, to go get a job for a few years and then apply to business school. Because I knew if I left school, I was not going to come back. So I applied to one school just because it was free. If you were in school, the application was free for Harvard Business School. So I was like, it doesn't cost me anything but a little time to fill up this application. So I might as well. Didn't think I was going to get in, but, you know, by some miracle, they made the mistake of letting me in. So, went to HBS and finished that in 2008. Left there to go to my first and only corporate job at GE Energy, working in wind and solar, which I still have a passion for renewable energy and alternative energy. But also, again, I realized quickly that, you know, the corporate life wasn't going to work for me. So quit that after 2 years. And then I've been, you know, an entrepreneur and investor and consultant ever since then. Then in 2013, I discovered Bitcoin. So I was just basically trading, and then I got into Bitcoin ATMs and stuff, and, you know, did pretty well in that. So I used my profits from that to invest in startups, and that's how I got my start angel investing. And now I'm actually taking that to the next level and starting my own venture capital funds. So, you know, going from managing my own money to, you know, managing other people's money, investing in startups, and we can talk about exactly what that's going to do later. And then the last major milestone in terms of my career is in 2018. I published a book called In the Black 2050, which is a Black economic development strategy guide, basically how to organize our capital and the Black economy. And, you know, all the projects I've been working on since then are basically operationalizing and executing on the ideas that I outline in the book. So that's where the fun comes in, and you know, a few other projects I'm working on.
Yeah, so we'll definitely get into more of that, particularly around the book and some of your latest initiatives. But just to kind of level set, I know you and I, we've had a lot of conversations about investing and about cryptocurrency. And I think a kind of foundational piece of understanding some of these investments is really understanding our current economic system in this country. So could you kind of give a brief just breakdown of like our currency system, fiat currency, some of these terms people have never probably heard of, just so folks can get a good understanding before we jump into some other financial things?
Yeah, so the United States and most of the quote-unquote developed world has what we call a fiat monetary system, which basically just means that the money's not backed by anything, you know, real. So it's not backed by gold, it's not backed by property or anything like that. The central bank, and in the case of the United States, the central bank is the Federal Reserve, can basically print money with authorization from Congress. So the Federal Reserve doesn't just create money from nothing. Well, it does, but it still has to have authorization from Congress, so elected officials. So they approve a budget, and then somebody at the Fed goes in and credits that account with the amount of money. So literally, like, the money is created out of thin air. And these days, mostly not printed. So most of the money in circulation is not actual physical dollars. It's just ones and zeros. So somebody at the Federal Reserve presses a few buttons, and now there's a trillion extra dollars in the U.S. Treasury's account. A lot of crypto enthusiasts will like rail on the fiat system. The system is not the problem, it's how it's used. So like any tool is only as good as the person wielding the tool. So the issue is that we have basically a bunch of unaccountable people printing money with no good understanding of economics or what the best use of those funds would be. So you end up causing inflation, which is the main concern with a fiat system. If you print too much money, prices go up. Having a fiat system is not necessarily a bad thing. We need to be able to print money when we need it. It's just we need to use it on good things to allocate resources where they need to be allocated, like the infrastructure bill, for example, that's happening right now. Spending money on better roads and bridges and a better healthcare system is a good thing. Spending money dropping bombs all over the world, that's not going to result in us being any safer, is not a good thing. It's a waste of resources. So it's a misallocation of resources. So that's the only purpose of a monetary system is just to help you shift resources around easier. So we're not constantly bartering, figuring out like trading shoes for loaves of bread. It's just a system to make transactions easier. So it doesn't really matter where the money comes from.
I love that, because this interview is a part two to from the spirituality aspect of abundance mindset, and that, you know, the belief that resources are unlimited, or like money's unlimited. Right. But you have to be a good custodian of these resources. And it sounds like, our system is exactly that. Like, it doesn't mean anything. It's not, you hear the spirituality girls, I was talking about money is not real, but it kind of isn't. And,
money is an abstraction. Yeah, it's an abstraction. And going to the abundance thing. So money is unlimited. We can print as much of it as we want, but land is not unlimited. Water is not unlimited. There are finite resources on the planet. Until we start mining asteroids, there are finite resources on the planet. So if you create more money chasing after the same amount of resources, the price in terms of that money is going to go up. But that doesn't mean anything, right? It just means the price. If people still have the purchasing power, the problem is, if people make the same amount of money while the prices are going up, that's the problem. So if wages don't go up with the prices, then you have the gross inequality that we see now, where you have three people have the same wealth as the bottom, like 50%. So that's the problem with the system. So this is kind of a digression, but not really. Like, if you think about the specific example of reparations, everybody's like, well, they can never afford it. Because like, I've seen estimates from $15 trillion all the way up to $70 trillion. And at least now we've seen, because of COVID, they can print the money. They can print all the money that they want. The money is not the constraint. The constraint is, if they give us $15 trillion all at once, what's going to happen? Like, is the price of, you know, are the price of red bottoms and Maybachs going to go skyrocketing through the roof? You know, like, where is the money actually going to be allocated if they give it to us all at once? Or what? You know, so the issue is not, they can afford it. They could, the United States federal government has no constraint. The budget is irrelevant. The debt is irrelevant. There's no way, like, this is another thing. They're like, people like to compare the U.S. federal budget to a household budget. Like, if there's no money, eventually, you know, you'll go into debt and you'll default on the debt and you won't be able to pay your debt because you keep spending more money than you take in. But in the case of the federal government, which is not the same as states and local governments, but the federal government can literally never default on its debts unless it chooses to. Because even if the interest rate is 100% on whatever debt we have, we just print more money. Now, that eventually will cause inflation. So that's the constraint, but the money is not constraint. We'll never default. Like, you'll never not have enough money to pay Social Security. You'll never not have enough money to pay for Medicare. The issue is, will there be actual enough, you know, things for people who are on Social Security to buy? If we print all the money and then we buy up all the stuff, then there's no more stuff left. So that's the real constraint with any monetary system. So if it's crypto itself is not going to, like, Bitcoin is not going to fix that. There's still a real economy that Bitcoin has to deal with. So, but you take the power out of the hands of a few people deciding how much money to print and where to spend it, basically.
Interesting. So, you mentioned inflation. I know this idea of hyperinflation is something that we should be worried about. And there are potential other dangers if we aren't good custodians. When I say we, I'm more so mean the people making the decisions in the federal government. If they aren't good custodians with the money, there could be things like the collapse of the dollar, which is where a lot of, I know, crypto folks, you know, kind of sound the alarm. They see that potentially happening. There's even other kind of systematic failures that can happen. And I kind of just want to talk through for our listeners, are there ways that they can prepare? Because we talk a lot about preparedness. So are there ways that they can prepare for some of these things that could potentially happen if our federal government isn't a good custodian of the resources that we have?
Right. Yeah. So the result of irresponsible monetary policy and fiscal policy is, like, the worst case scenario is the collapse of the dollar, which is the same as hyperinflation. Like, that means the same thing. So the best way to prepare for that is to invest in things with real value and or financial assets. So I guess we'll get into the different scenarios, but if it's just like the dollar collapses, but then the world economy is still fine and, like, the financial system's still fine, we still have internet and power and stuff like that, like, everything's changed except for the dollar collapses, then crypto is probably the best hedge against that. Bitcoin, Ethereum is even better than Bitcoin, but Bitcoin and crypto in general is a better hedge against inflation than gold is. And it's easier to transport. Now, if you get to a situation where, you know, whatever causes the collapse also brings down the internet, then crypto becomes worthless and you need, I mean, there are ways around that, but you still need electricity, and it would be very hard to make crypto work without the internet. So in that case, precious metals could work, but presumably in that scenario, things are going really bad. Like, so if we don't have the internet and electricity anymore, something else went horribly wrong, in which case gold is probably not going to be that useful either. Like, you're probably going to need food. So the things that you would need to have invested in previously would be things to filter water, bullets, arrows, machines to make bullets and arrows, you know, bows, guns, things you can eat, not non-perishable food, stuff like that, seeds, so you can plant, assuming the atmosphere is still habitable, you know, seeds so you can replant and grow your own food. But yeah, so it depends on the scenario. If it's just a dollar collapse, crypto is the best way to prepare for that.
Yeah. So as we're talking about this, and it keeps coming up, I think in the Abundance Mindset episode that we recorded as part one to this episode, is I think a lot of people are like, you know, that's cute that you're talking about preparedness, or that money's not real. Money is very real for me, and my basic needs are not even met. And so, like, wanting to acknowledge that it's a privilege to be able to prepare in a lot of ways. So do you have any tips, like ground level, of balancing your immediate needs and then prepping financially, like more than just saving, but like preparing financially?
The very fundamental basic thing is you need to be making more than you spend in order for you to be able to do anything. So to prepare physically, you know, financially, if your belly is not full, then it will be very hard to do any of the things that I recommend. So I'm like, I start in terms of my work, and you know, when I talk about wealth building, I start from a place of you at least have some ability to save. If you don't, then that's your immediate need. You either need to spend less or make more. The place I'm at, I'm pretty frugal already, so I focus on making more, because spending less is not, would be pretty hard for me, because I don't waste money anyway. But you know, it might come down to making some hard decisions, or you know, sacrificing on a few luxuries, or you know, entertainment or whatever, for until you get stable. But once you get to a point where you can actually save, then it becomes about using your income, your extra income, to buy more income. So buy things that make money while you sleep. So that's like the first place to start. And then how you do that, there's whole entire books and courses on it. But at the high level, like I said, you look for passive sources of income. And this goes for, you know, preparing, like when we talk about survival preparedness as well. But right now I'm focused mainly on the financial preparedness part of that. There can be some overlap, because when you get into farmland and real estate, that's a good financial investment, but also a way of preparing. And like, farmland is probably the best investment you can make long term, or you know, from a physical survival preparedness standpoint. And then from there, you have other assets that I think especially Black folks aren't as much exposed to, like venture capital and private equity, managed futures, different real estate strategies beyond just, you know, simply flipping or being a landlord. So things like that. But where I like to focus more is on those alternative assets, like the, you know, hedge funds, private equity, venture capital, and then on collective investing.
You know, we, you know, talk about a lot how preparedness, and I think even investing, is often kind of a singular, selfish pursuit in a lot of ways in our kind of capitalistic system. I know you're really passionate about collective investing, trying to get folks to pool their resources to acquire things that on an individual level, you know, we as Black folks, a lot of ways, don't have the capital that our counterparts have. And so using that community to really further ourselves, I think is something that you're really passionate about. So love for you to kind of just talk a little bit more about that and why that's important to you.
Yeah. And again, from, you know, even when I think, when we're thinking about collective strategies, like, you know, cooperative economics and things like that, it's still, you still have to start with individuals. So the individuals still have to have something to invest, have to have, not be starting from zero, right? So, at an individual level, you can do easy things like, investing in crypto, which is super easy. Stocks, especially like dividend yielding stocks that pay you a regular dividend every quarter. There's this website that I use called groundfloor.us that basically allows you to invest in real estate debt. So you're still getting exposure to the real estate market without, you know, necessarily the risk on the equity side. So like basically they loan out to other real estate developers and you get a senior position in that cap table. So if anything goes wrong with the project, you get paid out first, but it's much higher. You get much higher rates of return than a bank account. So it ranges anywhere from like 5 to 12 or 13%. It's much higher than you will get in a savings account. So like things like that you can do easily as an individual.
What's the buy-in for something like that?
So ground floor, literally the minimum investment for each. So you actually get to choose the property. So you can choose, pick and choose the property. And they usually have about a dozen, like every time they launch, they release new deals, it's about like a dozen different options every time. So like maybe every couple of weeks. And the minimum is only $10.
Oh, wow. Property.
Yeah. So literally like anybody can do it. So that's why I say crypto stocks, that crowdfunding websites like WeFunder, Republic, StartEngine that allow you to invest in startups for as little as like $100 at a time. Those are good places to start. Because like if all you have is your 401k, it's gonna be very hard for you to, like, create life-changing wealth that way. Like it's over time it'll be, you know, decent, but if you're trying to enjoy your financial freedom before retirement age, then some of these alternative investments, I think, are going to be a better option. But then once you get into things like, you know, you can invest in startups through the crowdfunding method, but there are some downsides there. Like you don't have as much control. You don't have as much power. The communication is kind of lax because, you know, you're not a major investor. So they don't, a lot of these sites, they have issues with like, issuing updates about what the progress of the company. So you're kind of like, as a small investor, you're kind of kept in the dark. But once you get up into like, you know, $25,000, $50,000 minimum investments for things, then more opportunities open up. And then when you reach accredited investor status, which that whole concept is controversial and functionally racist, but it's the system we have. Accredited investor, I think the threshold is like you have to be worth, as an individual, be worth like $1 million or make over $200,000 a year, something like that. It's in that range. Then other opportunities open up to you. But ways around that, like if you're not at that level yet, but you want to get access to those opportunities, then you start thinking about cooperative and collective strategies. So another company I invested in, and I was a customer first, and I, you know, I saw the value in it, so I invested in it as well. It's called TribeVest. So that website is tribevest.com, and it allows you to easily set up an investment plan, like with a few friends. So, you know, you could get, you know, 10, 20 people together to go in on a property, you know, like a rental property, or invest in one of these startups. So I've started a few tribes. One of the tribes I started was actually a tribe to invest in TribeVest itself. So we actually use what I'm talking about. We use it. We use TribeVest, the platform, to do this model of collective investing that I'm talking about. So that's a good method to go, you know, to increase the range of your investing possibilities without having to actually be already at that level, like in terms of personal wealth, that level of an accredited investor, or, you know, things like that. And then, you know, just from a preparedness standpoint, not only investing collectively, but like building collectively. So like, you know, instead of you buying farmland by yourself, maybe you get together. There's actually a group down in Georgia that did this. It's called Freedom Georgia Initiative. It was like, I think 19 families got together and bought, you know, 500 acres or something, or 100 acres in Georgia, and started building. So like they're going to build their own infrastructure, their own housing, like eventually they'll control the police department, the fire department, and all that stuff. So like when you think about preparedness, you can go the, you know, let me build a $1 million bunker route and just be alone, or maybe just with my immediate family and try to eke it out. Lonely, miserable existence in this bunker, or maybe we create a resilient community that has maybe a bunch of bunkers, but like a resilient community that's, you know, food secure, generates its own power, its own water, and each person has their own individual skill sets to bring to the collective. So now, as an individual prepper, I don't have to know plumbing, electricity, woodwork, metalwork, HVAC, you know, how to connect a solar panel to an inverter and wire all that together. Like maybe I just know the woodworking part and somebody else knows the electricity part and somebody else knows the plumbing part. So you start to not only invest your money collectively, but also your skill sets and your talents. And I think that's a much more resilient method of prepping. Like, even for somebody like me, who's a hermit and, you know, introverted, I still don't want to be trapped in a bunker by myself. You know, like I'd rather just call it in, you know, at that point. So, so just thinking about collective investing, but also more collective living. Like, we are, you know, as Black people, traditionally meant to live. You know, African society is traditionally more collective, and, you know, Western European culture is more individualistic. So we've, you know, we've kind of adopted some of those bad habits in terms of rugged individualism. But thinking about things like, you know, collective building, like hippie communes back in the day, but like, you know, the village mentality versus the individual mentality in terms of preparing mentally and physically for whatever disasters that might come along.
Have you seen, like, with friends or family, like, this reluctance? It's part rugged individualism, but it's like this reluctance with Black people, like, about talking about money, putting money together, like this fear that they're going to get screwed, and like, we just don't want to do it.
Yeah, that's another result of our exposure to this system that we're in. Like, it was our common sense was literally beat out of it. So collective strategies and, like, you know, cooperative society, cooperative economics, cooperative social structure, that is a survival mechanism. That's how societies, especially like before the advent of major cities and civilizations, like, if you're a small group of people, you have to work together to survive, literally. And when, you know, when they got us off the boats here, they recognized that too. So they beat that out of us. Every time we try to collectively do something, they would punish us. So, and we're still suffering from the psychological scars of that trauma. And the first step is recognizing that that's what happened. Like, this has been a deliberate attempt to keep us from collectively organizing. So if you know that, you know, okay, maybe I have some biases. Maybe I have some reluctance on, you know, trusting people with money, even if, you know, maybe my personal experience, I have been running. So that's where the financial concept of diversification comes in. So you got to start small and spread your money out. So I'm not going to give my life savings to the first opportunity that comes along to start an investment club. So if I have an investment club with a bunch of Black people, maybe there's some trust issues there. So maybe we start at $20 a month, or $100 a month, something that you don't mind losing. And that's just basic investing advice anyway. Especially in the riskier assets, you don't invest money that you can't afford to lose anyway. So, especially on one particular investment, right? So the goal is to be as diversified as possible. So, like, for example, I'm in several assets. So I'm in crypto, real estate, stocks, in my own businesses. So that's an investment. That's my business, growing a business. So that's four asset classes right there. And then just within crypto, I have 60 different coins. Stocks, I've got 30 different stocks. So the real estate, where I'm in at least a dozen or two properties. So if any one of those, if one coin goes down, if one property goes down, like, I'm not worried about it. So diversification is key to kind of getting over that psychological hurdle as well. So it's like, okay, worst case scenario, I lose this money, but we try, you know, and eventually something is going to succeed. And, you know, once you succeed once, that success builds on itself. So, it is a hard, it's much easier said than done. So, like, it's a very hard thing. And that's why a lot of my projects are about organizing Black capital, organizing the resources that are already in the Black community, specifically starting with existing organizations. So starting something new from scratch, investing is already hard enough, and then starting a new organization to do it can add another level of complexity and, you know, some issues that go along with that. So we already have a bunch of Black organizations. Most people are involved in at least one. So even that, if that's church, so you can start with your church group or fraternities and sororities, Black professional organizations, you know, NSBE, National Black MBA, you know, things like that. Organizations that already exist, there are already chapters, you already have the social infrastructure there. So there's some level of trust, there's some level of familiarity already there. You can just add this collective investing component on top of what already exists. So I'm working on that within Alpha right now, trying to get more Alpha chapters to start investment clubs. But like, you can expand that to any Black organization. That's another way to kind of get past that trauma and those, you know, those biases. But the best way to get around that is to acknowledge it, research why it happened, how they've been able to do it. So, you know, when these tactics are used against us, they won't work anymore.
Yeah, I just want to jump in and comment. I think what you're talking about there, using that existing Black infrastructure that exists in a lot of organizations, it's a central idea that's in your book, right? So, you know, we mentioned earlier, his book's called In the Black 2050. Pretty quick read. It basically just gives guidance on how we can collectively utilize our existing infrastructure to produce, you know, these investment clubs that can then take over parts of the value chain and then eventually own industries. So definitely want to just, you know, plug it, highly recommend it. Check it out.
Yeah, I mean, that last point is key. So when we think about, so you think about your individual wealth, individual preparedness, and, you know, your immediate family and your immediate community that's physically surrounding you, but also looking at the Black community in general. I'm specifically focused on America, but this is a Pan-African project. So African people around the world, but no matter the level of your personal success in terms of wealth or in terms of popularity, career, you are still Black and you are still as vulnerable as any other Black person, right? So until we control systems and methods of gaining and using and wielding power, we're all collectively more vulnerable just because of our Blackness, right? So part of that is a lack of political power and a lack of resources, but the origin of that is our lack of organized economic power, which controls political power at the end of the day, right? So the fact that we don't control any major industries, we don't control any major companies or job creators, then it makes us more vulnerable as a whole community. So a lot of my work is focused on economic independence, controlling at least strategically important parts of our own economy, much less the, you know, the whole economy. I'm not even too concerned about that just yet, but that's a longer term goal. But just in terms of like something very real, like food, the Black community collectively does not have the productive capacity to feed ourselves. So at the end of the day, we're going to be reliant on whoever feeds us, on the food system that everybody else developed besides us. So that's like a very easy place to start. So collectively investing in farms, grocery stores, processing plants, and things like that, right? So,
Joe. Oh, I had a question. So Jen and Mick love the kids. We have two kids. And you have... at least one, right? One.
Yep. 15 months old, actually. He turned 15 months today or yesterday.
Oh, I love that. And you talked a little bit about diversification. Do you have any tips or like what you've done to set your child up? I know some people are like just save or college fund. I've also heard of people buying a house and then putting like an 18-year mortgage on it. And so then when it's done, if they're renting it out, you know, the kid is getting that cash flow. So I'd love to hear your perspective on that.
Yeah, it's very important. So savings is the worst thing you can do. It's just like having a savings account is literally the worst place you can put your money. Because of inflation, like we talked about before, and mainly because of inflation. So like the value of that money is literally getting disappearing every day. So we don't have any savings accounts for him. We have, so he's got stocks. He's got basically a pretty aggressive stock portfolio because, you know, we've got a 18 to 21 year time horizon, so we can afford to wait out the dips. He's got a diversified crypto portfolio, and that's pretty much it at this point. He also makes money because he does baby modeling. So per hour, he makes almost as much as I do. He just doesn't work that many hours. But yeah, so that's where we started. And there's, I can't remember the name of the app. I think it's Unest. Yeah, UNEST. And instead of like in his birthdays, people buying him toys and stuff, he doesn't, please, if you know me personally, don't get this boy any more toys. Books, yes, no toys. He's got too many toys. But we tell everybody to invest in his UNEST account. So like, you just send out and give to that step, you know, whatever. So we got that, and you can make it recurring. So like all his grandparents contribute to it monthly. So there's that. Oh, he also has a family business to inherit as well. But between the crypto and the stocks, he's gonna be good. And we're probably gonna do real estate is tricky. excuse me. So I wouldn't just buy a house. Like after that whole conversation about diversification, that's not, you know, anything can happen one house, right? And then also you got maintenance and all insurance and all these other expenses that go along with owning a house. And I definitely am not interested in being a landlord, like taking calls at 2 o'clock in the morning to fix a toilet or whatever. I have no interest in that. But when you get to multiple properties and can hire a property manager, then it becomes a little bit easier. So I don't know, like just for him, I'm not going to buy him. I will just buy him a portfolio of real estate that somebody else is managing and I can just buy it into. Maybe until I get to the point where I can personally just go out and buy a bunch of properties and hire a property manager, but I'm not there yet. So there's actually a lot of different startups coming up now that allow you to do this. So we talked about ground floor, that's real estate debt. There's one called NADA, N-A-D-A, allows individual homeowners to actually sell equity in their house without moving or without selling the house. So like right now my house is doubled in value in the last, since we bought it in early 2020. And I could either refinance and take out more debt, which I don't want to do, or I can sell the house. Like those are my two options. But this app allows me to actually sell equity in my house without moving. So I can just sell, like, and then when I sell it, the people who bought that equity get, you know, their share. But on the other side of that, as an investor, you can now invest in other people's houses. So they have these things called city funds. So I invested in the one in Austin that they have. So basically I own a piece of properties. I'm assuming it's quite a few, like in the dozens of properties throughout Austin. So now I'm not reliant on any one property and I'm also not a landlord, but I have the upside potential of owning real estate. So I could just like have that allocated. So I could buy one share in each of these city funds for each of my kids when they're born, and then that's their real estate portion of their portfolio. But eventually, you know, basically my son is going to end up having the same portfolio as me. Everything that I invest in, I'll just put a piece aside just for him. But yeah, dope. Starting off with stocks and crypto, that's the easiest way to start. And you can start with literally like $5.
So we wanted to discuss a little bit about spirituality and finances. I mean, we've touched on it a little bit earlier. But I think living in a capitalist society, there is a thinking, and I think it's changing, but the spiritual community sometimes feels like they can't charge for their services. A lot of spiritual businesses struggle with like charging what they feel like they're worth because they feel like they're taking part in capitalism, and that it's, I say this a lot, but it's either or. So how do you, I mean, you're in a lot of different things, a lot of things that are traditional capitalists. How do you merge your own spiritual beliefs with some of your investment philosophy?
Well, so I think the collective aspect of it is the beginning of that, right? So my concept of self is not limited to this meat sack that I currently inhabit, right? My community is also a part of myself. Like all these actions that I do are selfish because if they benefit black people, they benefit me. That's how, in terms of my personal spiritual beliefs, I also believe we are both our ancestors and our children. So if you have a larger concept of self, it's not really, you're not limited by what certain investments or certain actions, how they benefit you specifically right now, right? You're looking at a larger picture. Like, how does this benefit the entire community? How does it benefit me in terms of being a spiritual being? Like, does it make me feel better to provide jobs for people, to provide a way for people to survive? Or do I just want more so I can get a yacht, like, or two yachts or a plane? Or would I rather see that money go towards maybe easing human suffering in this existence that we have on this plane, in this reality, right? So a lot of my actual investing activity, the end result is to free us from having to work, or from having to work just to survive, right? But to the larger question of like capitalism, I wouldn't actually consider myself a capitalist. If you had to put a label, I would be a socialist, but these isms I don't think they capture it properly. Because so an economic system is only as good, like just like the analogy we talked about earlier, a monetary system is only as good as the people who are in charge of it, right? An economic system reflects the culture that developed it. So Western capitalism, Western European capitalism is going to create similar outcomes to Western European socialism and Western European communism. Like, fundamentally, the culture is more individualistic and their culture is hierarchical. It's linear. It's going to result in inequality because that's how their culture developed, right? Whereas African culture is collective, it's circular, and it's more equitable. Now, there are hierarchical structures, right? But even a monarchy in traditional African society like 1,000 years ago would look nothing like the monarchies we envision today, right? Like, kings can be deposed and were regular. Like, if the king was not acting in the best interest of the people, that king could find his head missing from the rest of his body. So it's not, they weren't all powerful rulers, right? So in terms of like economic system, we have to reimagine what a system based on our spiritual values and, from my personal perspective, African culture and traditions and beliefs systems, like, what does that look like? So actually, the Rebirth of African Civilization by Chancellor Williams actually goes into that. So he does a deep dive into like going into a bunch of villages in Africa. This was in the 50s or 60s. So still while colonization was happening, but kind of doing a deep dive into how were African societies set up before Europeans, and then even while Europeans were occupying the physical space, like, they still kept a lot of traditions going. But and it looks much different than what we would recognize as capitalism, but still there are economically valuable activities going, right? So one thing, if you just look at the pure definition of capitalism, it's about private ownership of property and productive assets, right? And maximizing profits. But it doesn't define what profits are. These people have defined profits as money, right? We don't have to put that limitation on ourselves. We don't have to define profits as money alone. We can define profits as decreasing child infant mortality or increasing quality of life or increasing labor force participation or whatever statistic or economic measure or even spiritual measure. How happy are the people in our community? Like, do we have a way to measure that? Do we have do people have enough time to take off work and enjoy themselves? Do people have time to go on spiritual journeys and not have to worry about how they're going to pay their bills? Like, if we own the companies and own the methods, the means of production, we decide what happens with the surpluses and the value that's created, right? So this is why I'm a proponent of employee and community-owned co-ops. So the research has shown that employee-owned businesses are usually more resilient and more productive than centrally owned businesses, right? So even from a pure financial perspective, it makes sense. But in terms of quality of life, a CEO making 100 times the employee while you've got his employees are on food stamps, that doesn't make any sense in terms of sustainability of your society. That society will collapse eventually, right? It doesn't make any sense. And then from a spiritual perspective, why would you do that? Like, why would you allow this level of suffering when you have the ability to do something about it, right? So that's kind of like how I think about marrying my spiritual beliefs in terms of just what can this wealth do? Not building wealth. Building wealth is not the goal. It's me and my community happy and make this existence, because this existence is already hard enough. Being a human is hard. You know what I'm saying? Like, we're born into this, having to constantly feed ourselves and keep ourselves alive and do all the shit that we don't want to do just to survive. Why make it hard, right? So if we can do things to make that easier and use money, this abstraction that we invented called money, money is just something to make transactions more efficient, right? So we don't have to feel bad about having it or making it. It's just so I can go out and get food without bartering a shoe or whatever. You know, it just makes it easier. So you don't have to feel bad about charging and making money. Now, where these decisions come into, like, where we start feeling bad, okay, am I the only person on this $100 million yacht? Why do I feel like I need this $100 million yacht when people in my actual community are, like, children in my actual community are starving? That's where these decisions are coming. So you charging for your spiritual course is not the issue. What you do with the money, that's where some of these questions can come up. So making the money is not a bad thing. And I didn't know that was a long way to answer that.
No. I loved it because I think we've talked a lot about deconditioning. And I think even like the terms capitalism, socialism, communism can be loaded because most people they haven't taken an economics class, maybe not since high school, if ever. And we've been kind of gaslit into thinking certain ways about certain systems.
When we think about economic systems, we get caught up in the how, but not the why. Like, what is the purpose, right? What are the outcomes we're looking for? So, you know, pure market-driven capitalist society, the outcomes are stock prices, basically. Like, financial outcomes are what you're primarily concerned with. But we don't have to operate that way. We can build our own economic system that does not put financial profits in. Financial profits are just one measuring stick into how sustainable the enterprise is. So, like, if we keep losing money, then we're probably not going to be around long, because we're probably doing something wrong, right? So it's kind of a measuring stick, but that's not the end goal. The outcomes we need to be looking at are, like, personally, I want, like, if I had an island and I was the president of the island, I would design the economy so none of my people had to work. They could work, you know, I would make it so that they didn't have to work. They could do whatever they want. So if you want to be an artist, you can be an artist, but maybe, like, somebody like me, I like to start businesses. I like to run. I like to make things. I like to do things. So it's not like nothing would happen. There are people who like to do things. Like, like to do economically valuable things, you can say, but I don't want that to have to be our lives. Like, I don't want us to have to work just to survive. So I would design my economy around that. Like, how can I make this? So, in, for example, we're in America, we're dealing with the fourth industrial revolution and automation, right? So, like, our system is not designed to deal with automation, because automation necessarily basically kills jobs, right? So that, you know, a machine doing something that a human used to do, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but if you have a economy where somebody's value and somebody's worth is determined based on their economic contributions, like what they can produce, then humans are going to lose against machines. So you've got to reimagine what a system looks like. It would look kind of like Star Trek. So the machines do everything, but people are still good, right? And this is also where the community wealth fund concept comes in mind. So I don't like unions, but not because I'm a capitalist. It's because unions are a 20th century solution to a problem that doesn't exist anymore. Our problem now is what to do with people when machines take over everything, and unions can't deal with that. So if I was a union, I would take my pension or whatever and invest in the technology that's going to displace all my union members. So if I'm a taxi union, I'm investing in automated car, automated driving, self-driving cars. Like, I would invest in whatever technology. So when that happens and those massive profits are made by whatever companies do that, now my members benefit, and maybe my members don't have to work now because, like, that windfall of profits that they got from the machine. So, like, machines taking over a job is not a bad thing. How we deal with people who've lost their jobs is the issue, right? So the community wealth fund is, like, kind of my part of the solution to that. But that goes into, what is the economy for? Our economy is to exploit people. The United States economy was built on and relies on exploiting labor to this day. Like, it was built on free labor, but it relies now on exploiting labor, which is why we outsource all things to save a few cents on our, you know, our toys, because we want everything made in China. And this is why they tolerate immigrants, because they just use them as cheap labor forces. So every generation has its new immigrants that come in. You know, started with us, then Chinese and Irish and Italians and Mexicans now. So, like, they're always looking for a labor pool to exploit, because the system is set up to exploit and devalue labor, and for capitalists, the people who control the capital, to control everything, right? But we don't have to do that.
Man, I think you've dropped a ton of knowledge on us in this conversation. And you've given us quite a few websites and even a book. I just wanted to ask if there were any other resources that were top of mind for you that you'd want folks to read, or websites you thought folks could get a lot of value from checking out.
Oh man, there's so many. So I write about a lot of this stuff on the website. So my book is called In the Black 2050, and that's also the website, theblack2050.com. And there's a blog on there. So, and then there's an email list. So getting on that email list, checking out the blog, and a lot of that stuff I'm going to start sharing with Black Star Capital Network too. So, you know, both of those resources. In terms of books, from like African culture and you know, like African-centeredness, there's a few. So African-centered consciousness versus the New World Order, also by Amos Wilson. This next one is fiction, but it's actually like philosophically very deep, and it kind of speaks to like African philosophy and like how we set up societies. It's called The Healers by Ayi Kweyama. And what was the last one? Oh, if you're coming from a Christian tradition, The Autobiography of Jesus and the Circle 7 Quran are two that kind of like, because so I was raised Christian, but kind of went away from it just because of all the hypocrisy, and like, I don't like it when people don't answer my questions straight, right? Or tell me things that don't make sense to me. So kind of got away from it. But when I started to dig in further into like Jesus's actual teaching using sources other than the Bible, which purposefully leaves out a bunch of information because of, you know, the Council of Nicaea, the Catholic Church, and all this suppression of information, you get into what Jesus actually taught and like figuring out what he did during those missing years that they don't talk about during the Bible, and like how his actual mission was, he was working on, and how he, you know, his kind of philosophies. Then I started getting back into it and seeing how it's really a very African-centered tradition, right? It's about taking care of the least of these, which you can get from the Bible, but it's also about the power that individuals have to manifest their own reality and to increase their spiritual powers and awareness in this lifetime without having to die first, right? So some things in the Bible are like metaphors. Some things you can take literally, some things you can't. But when he said, you know, I don't know the direct quote, but basically when he's talking about like everything I can do, you can do as well. And I'm the way to, he wasn't saying like the way to heaven was through him. It was, he's showing you how to get to that consciousness, that Christ consciousness, that heaven consciousness through his teachings, but you can do it. You don't need him to do it. You can do it yourself. You have the powers, you have the spiritual awareness, you were born with these, and you touched the tree of forgetfulness on the way here. That's an Ifa thing, it's getting out of Christianity, but we gave ourselves amnesia to experience free will and experience and have this experience and build on our own spiritual journey. But the suffering that we're going through, the ego-driven reality that we're in is not necessary, and we can escape that if we want to, and we have the power to do it. So, but anyway, those two books, autobiography of Jesus was probably the best one in terms of like my spiritual development and then reconnecting back with like a Christian tradition. And then, even though I'm still not a practicing Christian, I practice Ifa, but I see now more of the connections, right, between Christianity and like African spiritual traditions.
Dope. Thanks for those. So we will link to those in our show notes. Lastly, you mentioned your website, but is there anywhere else on social media or anything that you want to tell folks that they can, come and connect with you?
Yep. Just Trey Baker on LinkedIn, and then In the Black 2050 on Instagram. I'm not very active on Instagram. I'm most active on LinkedIn, so that's probably the best way to reach out. Yeah. And then I've set the blog and the email list on intheblack2050.com.
All right, man. Well, thank you so much for the time. Really appreciate all the knowledge. All right. So hopefully you guys enjoyed that conversation with Trey. As we wrap this episode up, I did want to touch on one thing that we didn't really talk about in our conversation with Trey. And it's really important for preparedness when it comes to finances. And that is having some emergency cash on hand. We operate in, you know, this digital electronic space. Most of the times people don't carry a lot of cash. I have, you know, tons of businesses that I've interacted with that don't even accept cash, right? They're purely cashless operations. So we're seeing that the world is kind of moving away from using cash in everyday commerce.
Yeah. And then even without engaging with businesses, you know, like giving money, like tithing a church, that's pretty much cashless. You know, just interacting with your friends, we're much more likely to talk about Cash App versus like, hey, you got $10, you got change. Like, no one even gives change anymore. Like, remember people would be like, hey, anybody got change for a 20? Like, we don't do that anymore. Plus, for me personally, being inside in the pandemic, that cut back a lot on my cash use. Like, we're not going out. We don't, like, valet anywhere. That sounds real bougie, but we don't valet. We don't go to the car wash. We don't do any of, like, the little things that maybe we would have had a little bit more pocket change for. So, I'm not ashamed to admit that there have been a couple of times that I've been out and about recently and thought, shit, I don't have any money. Like, it was like, oh, I don't know the last time, like, I think one time you asked me, like, somebody came by the house to sell something. You were asking if I had any cash in my wallet. I was like, I have no idea. I haven't looked in there in months. So those were small issues and, like, small, very small inconveniences because, like, I probably would be late somewhere, but I could go get some cash. But, you know, how could not having cash look in a more dire situation?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen, you know, in a lot of these, like, regional emergencies, we just had the hurricane that, you know, knocked out power in New Orleans. You know, in these situations, power's out. Businesses may be still open, like the grocery store here in Texas was open during the ice storm, even though they didn't have lights. They were kind of using backup generators and whatnot to kind of keep the food, you know, cold and frozen. But when you went in, they didn't have the power on their cash registers. They didn't have, you know, any ability for you to tap or swipe or anything with your credit cards. So you had to have cash. And I just think when we're thinking about preparedness, we're thinking about some of these natural disasters that could occur, it's just a really good idea to have one of those fireproof, waterproof boxes that you can kind of keep your documents in, but also have just enough cash to be able to fill up your tank with gas and be able to buy, you know, a week's worth of groceries at a grocery store.
For sure. I would also suggest, and I did this before the pandemic, keeping a few dollars in your car. Nothing like, not a huge amount. Like if your car was ever broken into, you wouldn't be like, oh my gosh, I have $500 in the car. But like, I used to keep like probably like 5 to 10 ones in like my glove box just for like little things that I might need it for, you know, as they may come up. So we felt like we really couldn't end a financial preparedness episode without mentioning like having some type of storage of cash. And I think in the vein of like what we were talking about earlier with Trey about like, I can't go get $500 out of the bank right now and just like store that in my closet. Like I need that. But making a plan, you know, we definitely made a plan of like over time, $20 here, $50 there, and putting that in the closet for an emergency and just like making that a priority. And hopefully, you know, you get to the amount that you want to have mm-hmm. before something happens. But at a minimum, you'll have something.
Yeah. I mean, every financial advisor will tell you to have an emergency fund for, you know, 6 months to 12 months of expenses. And I would just say take a portion of that out in cash and keep it in that lockbox.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, check out the show notes where we will list all of Trey's many recommendations. We're going to be busy building that show note for a while. But check those out. We'll have great links in there. Yeah.
There were a lot of concepts in there, a lot of resources, but then just a lot of like financial concepts and ideas and schools of thought. So like I would just encourage you, if there's something in here that you're like, what? Google it. But and then as always, you know, feel free to hit us up and email us at shockersandshotguns@gmail.com. We're happy to take any questions. And even if we need to send them off to Trey, we'll also get him included, too, if it's above our pay grade.
For sure. For sure. You can also DM us on Instagram. We've been getting a lot of questions there as well. So, yeah, follow us there at Chakras and Shotguns and check out our YouTube channel, Chakras and Shotguns.
Yes. And we love reading the reviews that you guys leave, guys and gals, leave on podcast apps. So please, please keep those coming. And if you love us, show us and rate us 5 stars. Thank you.
Namaste.